Chapter 28. At last, just as dawn was breaking over the horizon, we reached the docks at Greenwich. Stoker and I had, after a spirited exchange of views, decided to hand the Baroness over to the authorities.
"You've no call to summon the police, do you?"
Corrigan asked nervously.
"It would be no more than you deserve,"
Stoker replied with a narrow look. Corrigan ducked his head.
"Come on, Gov. You know what it's like for a sailor, trying to make an honest shilling. Sometimes the work just isn't there, and I've 7 mouths to feed at home, I do, and Weaver there has 9.
Remind me to have an instructive discussion with your wives on the precautionary arts, I told them.
Come again? Family planning,
Stoker explained dryly.
It would keep your wives from being subjected to more expectations, and you lot from having more children than you can reasonably support.
That's not natural, that isn't,
Corrigan protested. And starvation is, I put in tartly. I shall send along pamphlets. Promise to read them, and we will not refer this matter to the police. Corrigan relaxed visibly.
That's mighty kind of you, miss.
He gave me an address to direct the pamphlets to, as Weaver took up the bound form of the Baroness and set her onto the dock. Her hair had been whipped free of its plaits, and it hung in great silvering hanks about her face. She looked older, but there was still a trace of defiance in her eye.
You cannot possibly think that you will get away with handling the lady-in-waiting to the hereditary princess of the Alpenwald in such a fashion,
she said, lifting her chin to an imperious angle.
I demand that you release me.
Oh, we will,
Stoker assured her. He pointed behind her.
Into their care.
Coming down the dock were a number of figures, cloaked and hooded against the chill, but each wearing the distinctive dark blue of the Alpenwalder wool. Captain Durand, his head wrapped in a considerable bandage, flanked by the Chancellor and the Duke, their expressions grim with purpose. And leading them all, Her Serene Highness, Princess Gisela. The princess spoke in a low voice that commanded attention.
Baroness von Wallenberg, according to the authority of the laws of the Alpenwald, you are to be taken into custody by the Chancellor's men and transported back to our country, where you will stand trial for the murder of Alice Baker Green.
The Baroness gambled all in one last throw of the dice.
You will never find me guilty. You cannot. You have no proof.
No, they do not, said a new voice.
From behind the Chancellor came a creaking noise, and he stepped aside to permit an elderly woman in a bath chair to propel herself forward.
But I do, she said.
Pompeia Baker Green, I exclaimed softly to Stoker. She held up a small, familiar medal.
Alpenwalder Kletterverein Gipfel Abseichen, she read in halting German. Your summit badge, Baroness, buried with my granddaughter, and the climbing rope cut by your hand.
The Baroness looked around wildly, but there was no mercy to be found.
There is also the body of Vilena and a mask that matches the description of the figure seen on the Teufelstrepper the day Alice died,
the Chancellor said.
You cannot escape this,
he added sternly.
You will answer for what you have done.
At this, the Baroness gave a deep groan and seemed to fold in on herself. The Chancellor signalled, and Captain Durand came forward slowly to take her in hand. As he led her away, the figure in the bath chair pushed herself towards us.
Mrs. Baker Green,
Stoker said, inclining his head.
One and the same. Mr. Templeton Vane, I presume? Miss Speedwell, it is good to see you again,
she said, giving me her hand. It was cold and rough, the flesh tempered by decades of pitting herself against the unforgiving granite of the world's most demanding mountains. It is an honour, I told her. Princess Gisela came to stand behind her. She glanced at Stoker's unorthodox garments and the coat flapping about my curves. Come, the pair of you must be half perished from the cold. Let us return to the Sudbury. There are many things to say. As we walked away, Stoker put his arm through mine, as Tommy and Billy waved an obviously relieved farewell.
It would serve them right if we handed them over to Mornaday,
he mused.
After all, they did conspire to abduct us.
An abduction they ultimately abandoned, I reminded him. Besides, we now know two men in possession of a boat and flexible morals who feel they owe us a favour. That, I have no doubt, will someday come in handy.
Stoker groaned by way of reply, but I stopped his protest with a kiss, short and hard. You owe me a pound.
Why in the name of seven hells do I owe you a pound?
Because an Alpenwalder has indeed proven our villain, I said, with deep satisfaction. He reached into his borrowed pocket, but I stilled his hand with my own, clasping it warmly. Keep your money this time. Come along, Stoker. The sun is rising, and we have lived to see another day. A few hours later, we were bathed and dressed and comfortably ensconced in the drawing room of the princess's suite, devouring plate after plate of Julien Dorland's best efforts. Try the miniature pork pasty, I urged Stoker, as I passed him a tiny pie capped with a caramelized shallot. He has done something quite wonderful with apple and sage. He took one, passing me the tray of petite eclairs, stuffed with violet creme. The princess watched us in bemusement.
Do you always take your own attempted murder in your stride?
I considered this. The first time is unnerving, I admitted.
But when it gets to be habit, Stoker added, one must adapt a rational attitude and make certain to eat to keep up one's strength.
I resisted the urge to pull a face. For a person who had spent the greater part of our confinement complaining bitterly about the predicament, he was quite sanguine now that he was warm and fed.
You must forgive me, Gisela said quietly. I had no idea anyone would be in any danger at all.
There would not have been if they hadn't meddled,
Maximilian put in. Reasonably, I decided. The Duke is correct, I said, reaching for an adorable cherry tartlet glazed with amaretto syrup. We exposed ourselves to danger with our investigation.
An investigation about which you neglected to inform us,
the Chancellor said, in a tone of lofty reproach.
As you neglected to inform us of the potential dangers to the Princess,
Stoker reminded him, smiling coolly over a tarte au citron. The Chancellor had the grace to look embarrassed.
I remain abashed at my failures,
the Chancellor said.
Hardly yours,
Gisela put in. She stared hard at Maximilian, and to my astonishment he flushed deeply.
Duke Maximilian? I prodded.
He shifted in his seat, then burst out in a torrent of speech.
The princess and I have had a lengthy and comprehensive discussion, and she has impressed upon me the fact that I have, in every possible way, let down my country, my name, and my royal blood. I extend my deepest apologies to you, Miss Speedwell, and to you, Mr. Templeton Vane.
He turned to the princess.
I apologize to you as well, Your Serene Highness. I know, too, that you cannot forgive me. I will not ask because I do not deserve it. I will resign my commissions formally and withdraw from public life in the Alpenwald. I await your further instructions.
He rose to his feet and bowed sharply from the neck.
I am, contrary to the cowardice and weakness of character I have demonstrated here, your servant, Your Serene Highness.
He drew his sword from his scabbard and laid it gently at her feet.
I offer you the resignation of my commission in the Alpenwalder Guard, and I will accept whatever punishment you see fit to meet.
He bowed once more and left us, shutting the door softly behind.
Princess,
the Chancellor began,
do you not think you should speak with him?
The princess shook her head. No, I think a little time to meditate on his sins will do Maximilian a world of good. Besides, we have other matters to discuss. She turned her attention to Stoker and to me.
I really am very sorry that you are brought into this farrago, she began. I never meant for any of it to happen.
I think I can piece together some of it, I told her. It began that day in the Curiosity Club when Stoker realized that Alice's rope had been cut.
Did it?
She sighed and gave Pompeia Baker Green a sad smile.
I think we both wondered. Alice was such a careful climber, so mindful of risk. It seemed impossible to us that she would have made any such elementary mistakes, especially on a climb she had done so many times before.
I made my peace with it, Mrs. Baker Green said slowly. One learns to when there have been enough of these kinds of losses. I wrote to the princess and told her that one must befriend grief. It is a companion that never leaves. I thought of the losses I had known, my aunts, my friend the Baron, and others. For some, grief was a devil, to be shut out upon the doorstep and ignored. But the notion of accepting that it would be a constant visitor in one guise or another seemed to me the beginning of wisdom.
I tried, the princess said, a plaintive note creeping into her narrative. But I could not dismiss the idea that something was wrong. Then, when Mr. Templeton Vane found the rope, I had the first real proof that I was not simply rejecting the banality of an accident befalling Alice, and at that moment another proof fell into my hands.
The summit badge, I said. The princess nodded.
Alice was buried with a badge, and I assumed it was hers. They said she had been found with a badge clutched in her hand, and they pinned this to her clothing before she was laid to rest. But no one realized at the time that she had not worn her badge that day. The badge in her hand was the Baroness's. The Baroness told me that Alice tore it from her during the final struggle, I put in gently. I suspected something like that as soon as I saw a badge amongst her things. It was Alice's. I recognized it at once. There was a little nick on one edge, you see. She used to joke that she would make me replace it for her, she added with a smile. And the back of each is engraved with a tiny number, unique to the recipient. This is so the badge may be returned to its owner if it is mislaid. When I saw Alice's own badge with her things at the exhibition, I wondered immediately whose badge had Alice been clutching when she died. Alice was climbing alone that day. It was a dangerous practice, and one I discouraged. But she knew that mountain. It would have been a simple exercise for her. But if someone else was with her, why had no one come forward?
Unless they had something to hide, Stoker put in.
Exactly. I could not take the risk that the rope, thus far the only piece of evidence linking her murderer to the crime, would go missing. I had to take it into my own possession for safekeeping, but without alerting the murderer, whoever that might be. And I needed Pompeia's help to secure the second and most damning piece of evidence, the murderer's badge that had been buried with Alice. But most importantly, I could not permit Pompeia to learn of Alice's murder from anyone but myself. I owed her that. So she borrowed a maid's cloak and put herself on a train, the elderly mountaineer said, smiling fondly at the princess. The princess returned the smile. It was a stroke of grave misfortune that the storm happened to blow in that night. You see, I had it all worked out on the timetable. I would go to the Midlands, speak with Pompeia, and return by the milk train and be back in my suite before anyone missed me. She would authorize an exhumation to retrieve the murderer's climbing badge from Alice's body, and by examining the badge, we would have the piece of evidence we needed to find her murderer. Once that had been arranged, Pompeia would follow a day or so later, after she had arranged to retrieve the badge, whilst I followed my official program and signed the treaty. She gave me a searching look. You did sign the treaty, did you not? I nodded. I have my doubts about its legality, but I signed it. Her smile was one of satisfaction. I will make it right. I will tell them our copy was destroyed in a clerical accident, and we will execute fresh papers. The important thing was to secure the meeting with the French in person and play out the little drama of diplomacy. The rest is simply paperwork. It was a cynical view, but perhaps that ought not to have surprised me. Rupert had said much the same. Stoker retrieved the conversation, steering us back to the princess's narrative.
But when the storm blew in, you were stranded in the Midlands.
She nodded. It was the worst snowstorm in a decade, so they said. We were snowbound in Pompeia's house. The good news is that it meant no one was abroad to see me away from London, but it meant Miss Speedwell was forced to take my place. She smiled. I hear you were more than adequate. I am grateful. I did my best, I told her.
But you did not undertake the masquerade to help the Alpenwald,
the Chancellor said, clearly sulking. No, I admitted. I did it because I wanted to solve the mystery of what happened to Alice Baker Green. And in doing so, Miss Speedwell has done us a very great service, the Princess insisted.
Has she?
The Chancellor queried.
You were already on the trail of the murderer.
And everything else I was in London to accomplish would have been destroyed without her taking on my role of princess, she told him. We will be grateful to Miss Speedwell and her companion. This was clearly to be the official position of the Alpenwalder government, and the Chancellor bowed his neck to his princess, his moustaches gleaming in the morning light.
What will happen to the Baroness?
Stoker asked. The princess's mouth thinned. She has been given into the custody of Captain Durand for extradition to the Alpenwald. She has decided to waive her right to a trial and acknowledged her guilt. So she will be sent to prison, I ventured. She said nothing for a long moment, and when she finally did speak, it was with a chilly finality. She murdered not only Alice Baker Green, but Yelena Borisovna. As the intended husband of the victim, Captain Durand has certain rights.
Rights?
Stoker inquired. The Chancellor cleared his throat.
The captain has elected to sail from England to Germany and make his way down the Rhine. A sea voyage this time of year is a perilous undertaking, he said blandly.
Which meant that anything the captain cared to do to see justice served upon the Baroness would be accepted with a blind eye by the Princess and her Chancellor. I shivered as I realized how rough that justice might be. Was she to be bundled into a sack and tossed overboard to drown, as she had intended for us? Given the quick mercy of a bullet before being disposed of in the river? Or would Durand choose for her to be locked in a dark fortress for the rest of her life? The possibilities were grim. The princess turned back to us, brisk and businesslike. I mean to open Alice's exhibition on schedule tomorrow evening. Will you be there? We exchanged glances and nodded. Of course, Your Serene Highness. It would be an honor. Chapter 29. The next evening, we arrived at the Curiosity Club an hour before the exhibition opening in order to attend to the last details. Lady C was a whirlwind of activity, supervising the polishing of the display cases and the dusting of the various displays. That goat is most unsettling, she remarked to me, pulling a face. Ought we to leave it? Oh, yes, I told her, not relishing the battle that would ensue should we remove Stoker's pride and joy. At last, the preparations were finished. A wide velvet ribbon had been stretched across the doorway to be cut by the princess to officially open the exhibition, and tables had been laid with vast silver coolers of iced champagne and enormous wheels of Alpenwalder cheese adorned with bunches of hothouse grapes. Trays of lobster patties and hot roast lamb pies were passed, and Julien's enormous sugar homage to the castle took pride of place. The guests circulated, taking in the maps and photographs, and pausing to admire Stoker's goat, as well as a rather bedraggled stuffed otter that had been sent at the last moment by a prominent Londoner of Alpenwalder descent. I was most interested in the reaction of the Princess and Pompeia Baker Green. They remained together, lost in contemplation whilst the other guests mingled, drinking champagne and chattering loudly about their own travels and travails. The princess was claimed by Lady C to make the rounds of dignitaries while Stoker and I went to stand next to Pompeia. Her bath chair had been moved in front of Alice's portrait, the photograph of her standing atop a mountain peak, a suffragist banner in hand. Pompeia Baker Green sat regarding it thoughtfully as she took immoderate bites of Alpenwalder cheese and sipped at her champagne. She was a remarkable woman, I told her. I wish I had known her better.
She would not have liked you much in the end, Pompeia said firmly. The corner of her mouth quirked up in a grin. But only because she was sometimes wary of kindred spirits. And you, Miss Speedwell, are like my granddaughter, an uncommon woman.
I grinned. I am glad you were able to come, although I wish the circumstances had been more pleasant. Her steely brows rose.
Why? Death is part of life, child. It is not the end. It is not even the middle. It is merely a doorway. Alice is no further away from me than if she had stepped into the next room.
You are a philosopher, Stoker told her.
I am an old woman, she corrected, and I have neither the time nor the patience for pretense.
She looked up at him with an assessing eye.
I am also a connoisseur of good-looking men, and you, my dear boy, are an extraordinarily attractive one. Now, wheel me over to where they are pouring more of this champagne, and I will teach you a thing or two about women.
He did as she told him, putting his head close to hers as he refreshed her glass. I was still watching them when the princess moved to my elbow. Should you stand so near me? I asked softly. Someone else might notice the resemblance and surmise what we have been up to this week. She looked down the length of her regal nose. I am taller, and my jewels are much better, she said, not unkindly. I do not think we will be found out. Tell me, did you enjoy playing at being a princess? I considered for a moment. Not really. It is a great deal of work and very little freedom.
Ah, she said, smiling gravely. You understand me. Few people do. Alice saw the cage for what it is, gilded and studded with diamonds, but it is still a cage. That is what made her such a good friend, she added, her gaze drifting to Alice's portrait.
Friend? I asked gently. She caught her breath but did not look at me. I understand, I told her. She canted her head, giving me a thoughtful smile.
I think that you do. Our relationship was not one I could ever acknowledge openly, you understand. Such a thing is not possible here in England. In the Alpenwald, it would be utterly unthinkable. But she was the love of my life.
That is why you could not bring yourself to agree to marry Maximilian, I murmured, because your heart lay elsewhere.
How did you know?
I found the sketch, tucked under the endpaper of Alice's ledger. The sketch was illuminating and clearly drawn by someone who loved you intimately. She closed her eyes briefly, and an expression of pain flickered across her face. When she opened her eyes again, she had recovered herself.
Well, I will not be the first monarch to put aside my youthful love and marry for reasons of state, she said, turning a heavily jeweled betrothal ring around on her finger. Maximilian? I was aghast, but Gisela was matter of fact. The wedding is to be in the spring. I will advance him the money he requires to pay his gambling debts, and he will spend the next few months proving himself to me. Given how grateful he is for my forgiveness and his own embarrassment at his actions, he will be entirely biddable as a consort. But after all he has done... She turned to me, and there was a worldliness in her gaze that spoke to long experience of the failures and foibles of men. Miss Speedwell, you have known Maximilian a few short days. I have known him all of his life. He is a good man. He just does not know it yet. Responsibility will be the making of him. I will see to it. He put a threat into a box of chocolates for a fright, I argued, and he arranged for a bomb to be thrown at you. A silly note and a firecracker, she replied with a curl of her lip. He has told me all about his debts, and I can assure you his travels will never again take him to Deauville. I will pay what is owed, and that will be an end to the matter. I can only say that you are the best judge of the Duke's character, I said, my voice unenthusiastic to my own ears. She smiled. Do not forget, Miss Speedwell, he kept my secret when I asked him to. When I had need of him, real need, he was as stalwart a champion as anyone could wish. He pretended to have a torn dress for Alice so that she could stay in the Alpenwald without anyone growing suspicious. And I turned to him again when I decided to steal the badge and the rope from here, she said softly, her eyes lighting with amusement. He proved a rather better housebreaker than I might have expected. And then, when I went to Pompeia, he told no one where I had gone. I blinked at her. He swore he did not know, I began. Oh, he knew, and he told no one, just as I asked of him. For a long while, he even pretended to be courting Alice in order to throw off any possible suspicion that she came to the Alpenwald to see me. He has been a good friend, and he will make me a good husband, she said firmly. Will you be happy with such a choice? She regarded me in obvious surprise. Happy? I am a princess. It is not my place to be happy. It is my place to govern. And I will do so as Alice and I discussed. I will bring my country into the new century with new ideas. There will be resistance to our progress, and I am prepared for that, she added, her gaze steely. My own personal happiness matters nothing when weighed against the well-being of my people. Then I wish you every success, Your Serene Highness, I told her. I moved to curtsy, but she put out her hand to shake mine instead. Thank you, Veronica Speedwell. Chapter 30. At the princess's invitation, Stoker and I travelled to the Alpenwald as guests of the royal family and were accorded far more prominence than we might have expected.
I amused myself en route by reading the Daily Harbinger, which devoted several issues to the upcoming nuptials, complete with sketches of the princess's trousseau. There were no articles written by J.J. Butterworth, a notable omission, and one that told me she had not yet succeeded in breaking the story she had followed into Windsor Castle. Whatever game was afoot, I had no doubt she would, in the end, prove an able hunter. I was pleased to find a small article near the back of the newspaper that made mention of an expedition embarking upon the Canadian Rockies, an expedition that included Douglas Norton. He had, it was noted, left London in some haste in January and had decided to set out at once for the wilds of Alberta. Stoker was occupied with his book, a saucy French novel that had been banned in 17 countries, and with a hamper packed to the brim with various delights from the kitchen of Julien Durand, the journey passed pleasurably for both. The night before the wedding, we were summoned to the princess's audience chamber. We had been lodged in Hochstadt's best hostelry, a timber-framed inn that looked like something conjured by the Brothers Grimm. Every part of the small city had been bedecked with flower garlands in honour of the nuptials, and the air was heavy with the scent of the blossoms of St. Otild's wort. We arrived promptly, just as the clock tower in the town hall chimed the hour, sending forth an enormous mountain goat to bleat the time. The princess received us in her throne room, sitting upon a carved and gilded chair hung with azure-blue silk. She rose as we approached, smiling broadly. She beckoned to the chancellor, who came forward carrying a small cushion. Atop it rested two medals, each struck with an otter blazoned in tiny sapphires. "The Order of St. Otild, first class," she told us, as she gestured to the floor. Two blue velvet cushions had been laid for us, and we knelt as she presented us with our honours. It was the first of such dignities that either of us had been accorded, and I was conscious of a rush of pride that we had been of use in the princess's time of need. And as I noted the emerald-eyed stare of the lofty Guy Mauve, tucked behind his mistress's skirts, I was grateful that this time, at least, we had neither of us acquired a new pet as a souvenir of our investigations. A flurry of journalists attempted to question us as we left the palace, for we were a story in our own right, and I laughed much later to find our photograph, blurry and indistinct, featured in a column in the Daily Harbinger with J.J. Butterworth's byline, explaining that we had received our honours for undisclosed services to the Alpenwalder crown. True to his word, the Chancellor presented us with a clock, enormous and brightly painted, and featuring a sinister-looking goat which bleated the hour, and which I insisted Stoker keep to adorn his folly. The next day, we stood proudly in the cathedral as the princess walked down the aisle to take Duke Maximilian as her husband. We watched them exchange solemn vows, pledging themselves to one another for eternity, and I fancied I detected a new seriousness about the Duke. I could only hope that purpose and responsibility would settle him. For her part, the princess seemed happy enough, satisfied that she had done her duty by her country. And as she passed us, I saw a glint from within her bouquet of flowers, roses and St. Otild's wort and cascades of ivy. It was only a moment, but I recognized the glimmer of an Alpenwalder summit medal, and I guessed whose badge the princess had chosen to carry with her on her wedding day. Alice Baker Green would never be far from her thoughts, I knew. When they had signed the register and the procession had made its way out of the cathedral, We emerged into the sunlight to find the square thronged with Alpenwalders, flinging petals of St. Otild's wort into the air in celebration. The bells rang out, and trumpets sounded, and beer ran from the fountains. Stoker turned to me, the sunshine brilliant as it gleamed upon his hair. In spite of the crowds, he wrapped one strong arm about my waist and kissed me, a thorough and expert effort that left me breathless. "You are grown sentimental," I said lightly. "It must be the romantic in you. Next minute you will be quoting Keats at me." His mouth, warm and supple and infinitely skilled, curved into a smile.
"You are always new. The last of your kisses was ever the sweetest."
The prick of sudden tears stung my eyes, and I brushed aside a petal of St. Otild's wort. I put out my hands, taking his lapels in my grip. "I am sorry, Stoker."
"For what?"
His gaze searched my face. "That I cannot give you this, what Gisela and Maximilian have done today. If you need this, this proper and legal thing in the eyes of the world, I understand. I will release you," I told him, even as I clutched him fiercely. He covered my hands with his own.
"Will you change your mind about marriage?"
"Never," I told him. I paused, wondering if I would have to give voice to my feelings, if I could give voice to them. But it seemed he understood much of what was in my heart.
"Neither will I," he replied. "And even if I did, I would not do that to you. Veronica, I have no need to pin those wings of yours to a card and put a label to you, Mrs. Revelstoke Templeton Vane. You are, and always will be, Veronica Speedwell. And I could never wish you different than you are. Now, let us go back to London where we belong."
I thought of the letter nestling in my pocket, which beckoned us on to a new adventure. "With perhaps just a little detour on our journey," I said, linking my arm with his.
"What detour?"
he asked, narrowing his eyes. "That," I told him, "is for me to know and you to discover." His eyes lit with amusement.
"Very well, but I may also know a thing or two that you do not."
"Oh, really? Tell me," I urged.
"Better yet, I will show you."
He leant near to my ear, his lips brushing my lobe.
"I will imagine you Venus tonight, and pray, pray, pray to your star like a heathen,"
he murmured. "God bless John Keats," I replied fervently. He escorted me back to our lodgings and proceeded to demonstrate for me the wisdom that Pompeia Baker Green had imparted during their private conversation. The next morning, utterly sated and rather tired after a vigorously sleepless night, I rose early and dressed, careful to ease out of the room quietly so as not to waken Stoker, who was, poor fellow, utterly demolished with fatigue. Making my way to the cheesemonger, I selected the largest, most delectably fragrant cheese I could find and ordered it sent to England to Pompeia Baker Green.
"Would you care to include a message, Fräulein?"
the cheesemaker inquired. "Not at all," I told him with a smile. "She will know what it is for." I stepped out of the shop and into the cobbled street just as the sun topped the flank of the Devil's Staircase, warming the side of the mountain with its golden light. The sky was a brilliant blue, and the hillsides of the lower slopes, bright green with spring grass, were dotted lushly with the first buds of St. Otild's wort. A passing breeze caught the top of the Teufelstrepper, blowing snow off the peak in a long, lazy trail of powdery white, like the last feather from an angel's wing as it ascended to the heavens. I drew in a deep breath of cool mountain air and turned my face to the rising sun for just a moment. I thought of the discoveries we had made in the course of this adventure, the secrets left unspoken, and a whisper of a chill breeze brushed across my face, like the passing of a shadow over the moon. Just then, a familiar voice called my name from above, and I looked up to see Stoker, sleep-tousled and smiling down at me from the open casement. I pushed aside all thoughts of peril and secrets and raised my face once more to the sun. Whatever lay in our future, whatever our destiny, we would face it together, stalwart and devoted, I vowed. Excelsior! Author's note. The Alpenwald, with its customs, language, folklore, inhabitants, flora, fauna, and history, is entirely fictitious, as is its capital of Hochstadt and the Teufelstrepper. While many British princesses married into German principalities and duchies, George III's only sister to do so was Princess Augusta, the hereditary princess of Brunswick-Wolfenbüttel. Although Empress Frederick, Queen Victoria's eldest daughter, the Princess Royal, was in England during January 1889, she did not broker a secret peace treaty in opposition to her son, the Kaiser. Alice Baker Green and her family are also fictitious, although many female mountaineers were making audacious climbs during the 19th century, and two in particular, Annie Smith Peck and Fanny Bullock Workman, did indeed hold up suffragist banners in their photographs. The climbing rivalry between these two mountaineers was legendary, and both have provided inspiration for the character of Alice Baker Green. Many operas have been written with Atalanta as their subject, most notably by Handel, but the particular work referenced in this book does not exist. St. Otild is also a figment of the author's imagination, as are her otters rampant. This is Angèle Mersters. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of An Unexpected Peril, A Veronica Speedwell Mystery by Deanna Raeburn. This program was directed by Ryan Lissy, executive producer Amber Beard, edited by Josh Arakelian. Text copyright 2021 by Raeburn Creative LLC. Production copyright 2021, Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.